You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Hi, this is Meg Riley in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I have stopped recounting my weird dream last night so that we can have another episode of The View. Fantastic. And in just a minute, we'll be talking with Caitlin Breedlove, the new, brand new director of the Standing on the Side of Love program. Have you actually started, Caitlin, or are you so new that you're not even there yet?
You know, this is morning 8. Good morning, everyone. 8 days on the job. Coming from Boston. Happy to be here.
Great. Great. I'm really excited to introduce Caitlin Breedlove. As some people know, I was the founding director of Standing on the Side of Love. It's still one of my babies that I love very much and taught me a lot. And Adam Gerhardstein was working with me, and we both left, 5.5 years ago. Since then, Dan Furmansky came in. We deliberately brought in a non-UU, hoping to broaden it out, our hope, to an interfaith campaign. That wasn't what Dan saw as an organizer. He really solidified the base in really amazing ways. And then we had, oh my God, I'm spacing out her name, who's been there, Jen.
Jen Cho?
Yes. Sorry, Jen. Totally sorry. Who was also awesome. And the social media director, there have been several of those as well. So this is already veered around different ways. People have done different stuff. Campaign made to take up and move it where you want to move it. It's an open source kind of campaign. So, Caitlin, what brought you to thinking it would be fun? And, you know, what's your real hope? Like, bold vision, 5 years from now, 3 years from now, where would you love to see it be?
Absolutely. Well, hi, everybody. I'm really happy to be here on day 8 of the job. I think my first answer to that would be, they wear the yellow shirts and they show up. They show up. And I thought, people who are showing up and an open source campaign like Standing on the Side of Love, that's where I want to be. So, you know, I think in terms of, because it's relevant, my organizing that work that I came out of, I spent 3 years at the Highlander Center. When I was 21, I drove there in my white Saturn, mostly made of plastic, with all my belongings. And I thought I was going for a 3-month internship to sleep on the couch, and I stayed 3 years right after Katrina, organizing around youth stuff and coordinating their internship program. And then for the last 10 years, I've been the co-director of an organization called SONG, Southerners Underground. Meg has been very involved as well, has a lot of relationships.
Well, years ago, at the beginning, old friend, Mandy Carter, yeah, just some great people founded that intersectional work. When it was, and it still is difficult, but Black Lives Matter has just taken it to amazing new places of really intersectional work with queer and racial groups, just amazing work. And I always think the South, it's true in our congregations too, and we tease Joanne about Texas, but the rest of us have a lot to learn from the people who are ministering in more conservative environments.
Mission field.
Mm. Hey, Caitlin, tell us, you just touched on a lot of stuff. Tell us what you are seeing in Minneapolis that's so inspiring, because all we ever hear about from Minneapolis is from Meg. And, you know, so we want to know what you saw. We know what Meg thinks, but what did you see going on there that was so moving or important?
By politics of love. And I think the love coming in through the organizing to look at the kind of violence that you all have been up against, from what I understand in Minneapolis, the kind of ongoing late assault and the resistance that we've seen most recently in Minneapolis, but in Baltimore and Ferguson, where also to touch on the issue, Meg, one of the inspiring things is seeing white people, clergy and not, being willing to go in and not have to be the central protagonist of something, to be all in, right? Mm. Not having to say, I'm going to take my toys and go home, because this doesn't affect me, or I don't get to have the mic, or I'm not in the center, but to come and bring your full self into that fulcrum and hold it when it's cold and it's awkward and you don't know what to do, to me is just, it's the kind of organizing that I think is so exciting. It's the kind of organizing that I've seen through, you know, the UU's engagement in Phoenix starting in 1070 and with the immigrant rights struggle. It's just that willingness. So that's what I think is really exciting about it, and just hearing about some of the ways that also, it seems like, Megan, tell me if I'm wrong, but new leadership is being developed, right? We're at an incredible moment. I really like some of the things on CLF's website about, you know, leadership and excellent leadership for key moments. And when I think about organizing, I think about interventions. Where's that historical opportunity? And where do we really do, like, the each one teach one principle out of Black nationalism, you know, of how you actually think about, and the Black radical tradition, how you actually say, okay, it's not real organizing if I'm not bringing other people along and not developing, transferring skills and developing them, and just watching, that's what it looks like to me.
So the two things you're seeing is, one is that there's been a lot of UU ministers involved in this struggle in Minneapolis. I think that's the highest number of, you know, the highest percentage of UU ministers being involved in any of these places that have gone on, and the most, you know, and the fact that they're willing to step back instead of step into the front. And the other is the new leadership development, some of which is like going on, and CLF is providing some institutional support for that. I mean, Alina,
I think that while you see so many UU and UCC ministers, and there are a couple reasons. One is Lena, absolutely. Lena and Danny Givens, they're the faith outreach people of the Black Lives Matter Corps, and they really encourage and give specific roles to white clergy. I mean, twice now, mostly white women, but white clergy with stoles on have been pulled in between the police and the protesters. Because they calm the police, we calm the police down, not so much the Black protesters, but we calm the police down. And I love, that's a really great use. But we stand back until asked, which also is really different. And it's because we've been trained to do that, and we've been told to do that. So I really would just shine the light on Lena and Danny about why Minneapolis is different. And right now, I'm hoping to generate some resources to replicate some of the model. The other thing I wanted to flag, Reverend Sekou wrote a really powerful and sad, I thought, editorial in Religion Dispatches about the traditional Black clergy has not stepped forward because of this queer stuff and the respectability stuff. In Minneapolis, the Black clergy who are there are not from the large churches who are. And so the traditional power structure around race in Minneapolis is being transformed and broken down, and both tragically and joyfully, I would say. Anyway, Caitlin, you must be seeing that in all kinds of communities in your work in song over the years, that kind of, I mean, we're all seeing that generational leadership difference, but in that intersectional work, I'm sure that this is not a new issue for you.
I think one of the powerful things that happens is that Black Lives Matter, I think one of the things that it has done that's so powerful is say, put out that clarion call to the incredible Black feminists, Black LGBTQ, Black trans leaders, working class women and gender nonconforming folks, and said, it's time for you to lead, come forth. And Song's membership just followed that call. We were very central in Black Lives Matter in Atlanta and some in Durham, some of the real difficult stuff with Charleston. But the thing I was the most proud of was just to see the way our folks were like, okay, you're calling our name. We hear our name being called. We're ready to come forth. We're not waiting for someone else. And I do think the issue of clergy, we're not waiting for a very stereotypical kind of patriarchal vision of who's going to be the faith and spiritual leader that's going to come save us. We're going to be saving each other. That's what organizing is about, which I think is also what makes it different than pure advocacy, right? It means that, you know, as a queer person, as a person who comes from a mixed class background, as a woman, I get to say, no, it's part of saving each other, and I can play a role. I'm not here to save anyone else, right? Which I think is kind of some of the best stuff. When I read some of the stuff, Meg, that you've put out over the years, and some of the stuff in relationship that seems to be culminating now, it's a really different kind of model and example. And I'm really excited about it. I'm really excited about being part of it. So, you know, when I'm answering the question, what's my bold vision for the next 5 years, I think my vision is, how can I keep engaging? What's the bold vision of movement right now? And what's the role we need to play? And we can play in that. And so I don't even see myself necessarily as the one who's dictating a vision for Standing on the Side of Love alone, because while I have a lot of, as you get to know me, I have a lot of ideas. I'm certainly opinionated. It's also about who's already moving, right? And how to support and network those folks together so that for as long as I'm in this role, whenever that transition is, there's more strong organizing that's innovative, that's risk-taking, that's filled with heart, that's there and supported because I was here. And I think that's the kind of like outcome we should think about with directors, right? In any kind of role, directors of folks that are already like moving and rowdy and ready to get it done. That's a really different kind of directing, right? I feel like so many things are already in motion in UU congregations and more broadly in our world. So it's kind of where I'm at with it.
Joanna, do you want to ask your question?
Yeah. So we have MLK Sunday coming up this weekend. Does Standing on the Side of Love have any resources or any suggestions for this?
Yeah. So I am so new that it was really Carrie and Elizabeth and Nora that put this together. I just want to say that to give credit to their work. So we're going to be doing a couple of different pieces that are going to come out under one theme and basically highlighting some different partner organizations and talking about their work inside the theme. And the Standing on the Side of Love website will have some tools, but we felt that also given all the things that are moving, we're kind of putting forward some of the things that have been up there and then using this as an opportunity to speak directly to the constituency. So Carrie and Elizabeth and Nora have worked on a video because Carrie and Elizabeth are going to be hosting this 30 days of Standing of Love and for Standing on the Side of Love. And then the pieces with the partner groups are going to be around a couple of different themes. And basically that's how do we bring forth thinking about the gratitude and wonder of what's happening in movement in this moment. So those are going to be the pieces that are going to come forward. And then we have a couple other exciting surprises around kicking off communications for Standing on the Side of Love in this new chapter that we're really excited about. And I actually think we could learn a lot from what y'all are doing. This seems like a really great space to get to initiate some of these discussions and be really talking with people and bringing in conversation. So that's down the road.
Awesome. Yeah. I was wondering, Caitlin, how you think it's, I mean, after 8 glorious days on the job, how you think it's going to be different organizing in a faith-based setting, especially for a wacky faith like Unitarian Universalism, where you have celebrate our theological diversity. You can't just like go to Jesus as like a regular, and assume you've covered it. So I was wondering if that was a consideration as you were thinking about taking this job too. Like how did you frame it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that of all the sort of spiritual faith-based institution work, I align most spiritually with the UU tradition. I currently attend a UU church, but I feel most aligned there. I don't think that as someone who's not a Christian, I wouldn't feel very genuine working inside of a Jesus-only institution. But I'm very, through some of my work at Auburn Seminary and with other folks that I came into contact with, I love spirituality and faith-based organizing because of its opportunities. Not saying everything always goes perfect, but I think there's a way that when you engage, where does spirit come into the organizing? It allows us to transform more. So I was really drawn to this work because of that, because I wanted to be in a space where I could be talking about organizing in nuts and bolts, and I could also say, are we willing to be transformed in the service of this work? Which was our guiding question for my tenure at Song. That was the question that everybody had to answer in the affirmative before you ascended into a leadership role. I kind of hate that question because when someone asks you that, especially someone you really respect and love and you say yes, then after that they get to say, here's all the ways I need you to grow so you can lead. if you're really willing to be transformed, here's some feedback for you, you know? So I wanted to be able to have, from both a communications and organizing perspective, some open space where that was okay to go in. And not just okay, but affirmed and central. So I'm excited about it, but it's going to be an adventure for me. It's very different, you know?
Oh,
I'm sorry, what was that?
We have a hymn that has a line called, that says, we're willing to be changed by what we started. And to truly live that is a really radical thing, whether you're doing, you know, actively doing activism or just living your life and trying to be a good you. So that's a beautiful frame. And also, if I may offer a shameless plug, there's some pretty darn good UU preachers in Arizona. Susan Fredericks Gray, for example. So
I've noticed.
If you're unchurched, you might want to drop on by on Sunday morning.
I just went to her congregation to visit the other day, and I had a really great experience. It was great.
You have to be shameless about plugging our own faith. Goodness
gracious. CLF when you said you were going to be shameless.
well, there you go. You know, you can belong to two.
Yeah, two. You're not cheating.
Three? Four?
So, Caitlin, another real difference, I think, is all the, you know, in terms of leadership development, all these congregations and all these leaders of various kinds, was that part of what was juicy to you? And do you have fantasies about that on your eighth day? You know, there are so many people to call upon who have, you know, way back in the beginning, we did media training for 120 ministers as part of launching Standing on the Side of Love. Are you thinking in terms of, you mentioned leadership development right off the bat, so do you have thoughts about what that might look like?
Oh, Meg, you're really speaking my language now, exactly. And the fact that you put the word fantasy in there really works for me, because that's really the kind of person I am, for sure. I do. I see a ton of potential. Not that there hasn't been potential that's maximized before. The thing I love about open source is that I picture we're going to be putting together a new campaign plan based on just intaking some information and getting sharings. But I envision that as very much an opt-in invitational. I think that what I've been able to see so far, a lot of folks are doing their own thing. And how do we create some scaffolding and structure that's actually useful, not just like another model or PDF somewhere and lost in someone's, you know, email, but actually say, here are the things we can offer back, which I think was one of the reasons I was hired for this job, to think about what is the moment we're in with the organizing side of things, what are the interventions that could be made that could be uniquely contributions of this particular constituency, how can we build? I do think we're interested in how do we build out the constituency, and definitely, you know, talking about shameless, there's some good cross-pollinating conversations between Carrie McDonald and stuff about outreach and that. But also, how do we create opt-in invitational opportunities that are like, here's some frame of strategy, this is what we put together, if you want in, you got us. The other thing that I think I'm still really struggling with is that if I didn't have a personal life that I felt like preserving,
you're still struggling with something.
I would just go on the road, real talk. But I do want my partner Marisa to still be in a relationship with me, especially because I just moved to Arizona. I would like to have her not have the locks changed when I get home, you know. Otherwise, I would just go on the road and be like, hey, Meg, can I come over? Hello. How can I help? Because I actually think open source campaigns, the most successful ones I've seen built, is going where there's really exciting stuff happening and being able to say, how can I just be an extra set of hands for a while, build relationship, find out more, and then kind of networking those sites together. So I would love to do that, you know, 24/7 for the next 6 months, but it's going to take a little longer, a little bit more careful. So I'm hoping that we can also do some other of that through long distance. But that's really what I some of the things that I see. And then there's a whole bunch of things that I'm like, I bet I'll feel real different about it in 4 or 5 months because I'll just be able to learn a lot more.
When you look at the Unitarian Universalist Association, all these thousand churches, all these people, what do you use the phrase the historical moment in terms of the organizing. What do you think the state of our religious movement is in terms of its organizing potential? What's the historical moment that we're in?
Oh, wow. I love this question, too. This is just getting better. Well, I think that I hate to be a downer, but I do think it's very possible that with the Trump, not Trump, but his followers, mm-hmm. we might be at the beginning of a right-wing populist movement in a different, scaled in a different way. I think mm-hmm. the seething resentments we're seeing in the level of white supremacist activation is scaling up. And I think that's not just a response to Black Lives Matter. I think it's a response to 8 years of a black president. I think it's a response to, you know, fury that undocumented people are pushing back. I think it's a response to gay marriage. And uh-huh. so if that is the case, we just think maybe for a second that my hypothesis is right. I think the opportunity is actually one of all of the faith-based organizing I'm seeing, the Unitarians are some of the folks that are mobilizing the most, right? I think there's conversation and rhetoric, there's, you know, there's sign-ons, there's petitions, but in terms of just in the streets power, which is only one way I would mm-hmm. value it, but I do think it's important. What are we seeing? That willingness to go out and get in. So mm-hmm. if you have even a percent of those congregations that want to move inside some organizing structure, I think there's a really big opportunity to say, okay, who are we reaching? And how are we standing on the side of love, not only with, you know, Black Lives Matter, not one more, but against cultural backlash. And those of us, we know that not all UUs are white by any stretch of the imagination, clearly. And in fact, we're seeing some really strong UU leadership of color right now. But those of us who are white saying, okay, if it's not just about us being a protagonist, it's also not just about us utilizing tactics that sort of say, oh, hey, people of color, validate us. Look, we're doing great. But it's also about what are the kind of strategic interventions that we can make by standing on the side of love, by being rooted in that frame, against the cultural backlash where a lot of white communities are saying they either speak for us or they reject that we have a spiritual or faith platform. And the final thing, and this is a personal passion of mine, is just how we also get beyond the rhetoric where middle class and upper middle class white people are sort of saying, well, the bad white people are the poor white people. They're the ones that are causing this. This is their fault. We don't have anything to do with it. We're squeaky clean, right? And I think a frame like standing on the side of love can say, wait a minute, wait a minute. What do we have to look at? What do we have to transform? And how are we engaging with all of these different populations, not just in an election year, because these things will continue, but how are we continuing to engage that? So once you all figure out the answer for how to do that, then you need to give me a call, you know what I mean, and let me know how we can put all that into a new plan. So if you have
to play back what I'm hearing you say is that the historical moment's different because the other side, you know, is this cultural backlash that is going to become the antagonist to progress in a way that has been not true before, that you know, we're not only just protesting the state and the status quo, we're also engaging with an antagonist that's also popularly based, and that we're really fighting a cultural war, mm-hmm. you know, to use that metaphor, and probably we would be good not to use that metaphor, but it is a cultural contradiction that's going on in the society, and that we have a role to play as organizers and as faith leaders in the side. And part of that is that we stand for love against hate and fear.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And I would just add that there's a place for people. You know, some of the polls now of Trump supporters, what they're saying is, I don't see myself and my children as a working class white person in the future of this country. The gays, mm-hmm. the quote Mexicans, and mm-hmm. the black people who are now, you know, quote unquote acting up, which, you know, apologize for the right wing language, but that's exactly how it's framed, right? Mm-hmm. It's about black resistance, and it's about LGBT and immigrant resistance, that we have to say, actually standing on the side of love says there is a mosaic, right, mm-hmm. of that future where there's a place for a variety of people, but that's not in a sort of fake melting pot way. That's in a like justice frame, right? And I think that that is, that's to me feels like a more unique opportunity, that standing on the side of love and all the people involved have, you know, other opportunities to actually teach me and a lot of us in the movement about how to do that. I'm also very interested in not just congregations in the South, which would make sense, but congregations in red states, in really hard towns, in liberal bastions, because sometimes it's hard to move there, but also the places that aren't, because what can we learn about what they're doing that's working on the local level? That's really exciting to me. I nerd out about it.
Well, I'm interested in Rust Belt stuff. You know, that's like from Detroit to Buffalo. You know?
Because you have people who have actually experienced a tremendous loss in lifestyle. So the heartbreak is genuine.
Yeah.
The blame is, of course, another story. But the, you know, I grew up in Buffalo. I live there now. You know, so. I would love to talk a little just fundamentals of organizing. So I'm a member of a brand new chapter of Showing Up for Racial Justice in Buffalo.
Okay.
Great people. And a real mix of some seasoned organizers, some labor people, and some people who are pretty inexperienced, like myself. What's your advice about starting an organizing group? And what are your sort of like top three rules for organizing?
Okay, top three. Let's see. One is, I think, covering ground versus interventions. So I would say, you know, at Song, when I was young, I used to think, oh my God, we're always going to fail. We're trying to reach every single LGBTQ person in every southern state. Well, a third of the LGBTQ community lives in the South, you know? So it's completely overwhelming. And then I think when I started understanding more about campaigns, which I don't think is the only way, but it's an important lesson, I learned about interventions. Like, things are moving along, and you think, okay, we can make a really clear integrity-laden intervention right here. And who are the right people to do it, and what's the right time and how? And then you just go, right? And I think that that's something to think about, especially for search chapters in local places. You know, what's going to be an intervention that can be made where you're showing up right there and it matters, it makes a difference, as opposed to sort of like saying, let's just show up every Sunday, do the same thing again and again and again. Sunday afternoon, we're going to be out there. Well, that might be your tactic, right? But to know why that is. And then the other thing, I mean, I think some of the other things, that's a big one, but given some of the questions in front of us, it's also a question of like, how are you engaging, some people would say an army of the willing, but you could also say team of the willing versus team of the eager. Now, eager is important, but the eager don't always necessarily want to, you know, do some of the things it takes sometimes, right? You know, people can have a lot to say, but might not want to, like, you know, make sure the food gets to the meeting or door knock or do all this kind of stuff. So just making sure that you create opportunities for people to say, oh yeah, I want to opt in, you know, and you get to know each other. It's like, okay, we all said we were going to make these five calls. Did we do it? Right. And not letting necessarily sometimes the people come in with a lot of energy, but they don't necessarily have energy to talk, reflect, and do. It's mostly to talk. I hate to say it, but it's a classic organizing. So people come for different reasons. Are they coming to talk, or are they coming to talk and rock out a little bit? And then the third one, gosh, there's so many. It's hard to pick. But, I mean, I think one thing that I think a lot about in this time is how are people coming and saying, you know, I'm going to bring two people. I'm going to bring three people. And I have the humility to say, I don't have to be the expert. I don't have to be the center. I don't have to be the talking head. So a lot of what I look for when I'm IDing organizers that I want to help support and build with, a lot of my criteria is, are they developing other leaders? Are they coming with some humor and some humility? Because if they don't have a sense of humor, oh, I can't. It's just, how long can you go, you know? And then are they willing to take some risks and be innovative, not for the sake of risk-taking or looking cool, but in the service of this work, in the service of our movement? Are they willing to make mistakes and still come back and be wrong? I think those kinds of things might be really helpful when you're thinking about local chapter starting. I think chapters can be, you know, it takes tenacity. It's hard work. I mean, all organizing is hard work, but and maybe that's a little helpful.
No, it's lovely. There's also an intimacy that at the chapter level that is really beautiful. These are some a town of the scale of Buffalo. You feel like neighbors, even if you're, you know, different suburbs. So it's really exciting that way.
So I'm also involved here in Minneapolis, starting a Showing Up for Racial Justice group, which is for white folks. If you're not familiar with them, you can look at their website. And one of the things I've been struggling with in this followership leadership thing is I personally am obsessed here in Minneapolis with the police union contract. Dean McKesson has made an amazing website about the content of police union contracts, which are staggering. Oh my God, Austin's Joanne, you wouldn't even believe what's in there. And most cities. And so I feel like with the UUs in the congregations, when Black Lives UU was here last, they were saying, you know, use your privilege, get into rooms, we're in the streets because that's where we can go. And so I'm trying to figure out, because so much of the activism here is street activism, and groups like the NAACP have, I mean, they're doing, oh my God, they're doing amazing stuff. But the kind of leader-follower stuff of, like, saying, well, you know, at our church, we actually have contacts that could make whatever happen. I don't know what about union contracts, but grand juries or some of these pieces that we know we need to take apart that happened in corridors of power, and they happened because of street activism, that there's a moment to do something. But that's just one of the things I'm struggling with is how to use the privilege that I've got the best that I can. And sometimes that's standing in the streets, and sometimes I feel like it's got to be in the corridors of power. And so anyway, have you done that kind of work as well? Or is that you're more focused in the street organizing kind of stuff?
I've done some of both. I've been in an organizing shop with people who are real legal policy heads, but just even if they don't have all the law degrees, they're just designed that way. And I'm much more communications and culture based in my strength. But I would say that I absolutely see the importance of demands. I think it's the pressure on the Movement for Black Lives and BLM to sort of have one demand and then kind of a pretty white biased infrastructure saying, oh, they're not ready, they don't have real demands.
They have great demands. Yeah. They have fabulous demands. And
they have great demands.
Sites that lay them out, and that's all set. I'm trying to figure out how as white people we support those demands, yeah. Right?
I think it's really important. I actually agree, Meg. I don't always think it's about street action. I think there's times when actually people are with white privilege are also very street and class privilege are very street ready. And I think you can repeat a tactic and it doesn't keep working. And so I actually think there's times, like if we look at what is happening in Chicago, like BYP 100 and some of the black led organizing there, I mean, just to really push that pressure on Rahm Emanuel, just push it. They had to have that kind of focus, and it hasn't been just about being in the street. So I think it's about finding that balance. And I think it is about being able to, one of the things that was really helpful to me is being able to go in and push. And it wasn't always about outside escalated, like interventions of power. Like I remember one time when we had to do a action on the Equality Caucus around immigration. And it was like mostly LGBT groups sitting in on the Equality Caucus. Well, you know, the Equality Caucus was like, we're your friends. Why are you doing this to us? And just to have to go in and say, you know, you haven't been our enemies, but you could be our champions if you do the right thing today. Like, I had to learn a lot. I'm not naturally good at that. I'm not a very good incremental escalator. My tendency is I'm chill, and then I escalate when it comes to organizing. But I've worked with organizers who are excellent incremental escalators, and I've learned a lot about how that's helpful. You know, so if you wanted to nerd out about that more, I'd love to talk about it more, but I do think it's really important, and it's pushed me to develop my skills in training other organizers, too. Like, it's not enough to just know how to go shout at the police, y'all. You also have to be able to sit in that, it's really spiritual, sit in that spiritual embodied discomfort when sometimes you have to interrupt someone. And as a white person, especially when I've worked with white people with more class privilege, it's someone who could be their uncle. Like, they feel accountable, right? You know, whereas for me, it's like my family doesn't quite feel accountable in the same way. You know, I think about my grandfather who was, you know, a vet, working class Polish guy. I just can't see him feeling accountable to those guys the same way. You know what I mean? But for a lot of people, that's real. That's a real embodied emotional response. And how do we do that?
Amazing people of power in our congregations, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at any one of our congregations, the excess, and I mean, because you use our cultural creatives, and so but we kind of, sometimes I feel like in our social justice behave like, and this is not about this moment where I feel like being in the streets is absolutely important, but sometimes we behave like, you know, we're college students. I mean, that's all we can do is just stand there with a picket sign, when really we have so much power if we look around the room and actually talk to people about their roles and what's going on. And it's uncomfortable. It's really like, you know, against the rules kind of to bring up stuff sometimes. But
bad manners, but, you know, equal marriage was largely a judicial victory.
Yep.
You know, and I'm so proud of what you did on behalf of that, but, you know, we won that in the courts.
Yeah, but UUs were in the courts. There wasn't a court case that, I mean, starting with
Julie Goodrich,
Massachusetts, we were the court cases. And so we were both and with that very solidly.
How important is it to, you know, right now we are so, with implicit bias and everything, it's like we're all in our own quarters. And what I'm seeing is the fact that so often we have to cross across one boundary in order to get to another. An example being, I'm here in Texas, and, you know, like there was a Muslim mosque that was defaced. Okay, a lot of the people that go to that mosque are not going to be standing with me at the LGBT rights rally, or even the fact that I'm woman, a female clergy, you know, there are issues around that. But there was a bigger issue here, and so we came together. And I've been thinking about this thing of how do we, number one, how important is it? And also, how do we encourage people to kind of let down the walls so that they can talk to their neighbor who it may seem is just so completely different from them, but on one particular issue they may need to work together?
I mean, I think it's a really important question, you know, again, to think about it in terms of race. For those of us who are white, there are huge statistics now that we, especially middle-class white people, are the most socially, racially isolated, especially those of us over 35, that when they pull the data in the U.S., there's a huge segment, I think it's like over 70% of white folks saying, I don't have anyone in my close life who's a person of color. And a lot of folks of color saying, well, you know, black folks saying, well, I have a lot more experience interacting with indigenous, Latino, and Asian Pacific Islander people than y'all white people do. Like, this is, you're lacking some of the skills. And so where are the places where we're also thinking about the skills building to just be in conversation with each other? And like people say in the South, sometimes have good home training, you know. One of the things that I spent a lot of time with developing organizers was things that maybe you wouldn't think. For example, if they were from the North saying, you never address a black woman over 40 by her first name, even if you're close. You say Miss Sheila until she says, please call me something else, you're making me feel old or whatever. You know, but, you know, you don't stand up over older people and talk down to them, right? You don't stand up over someone who's sitting in a wheelchair and talk down to them. You know, you go where your eye level. Certain things that some of the people we organize with completely knew that from growing up, and other organizers I've trained who are wonderful, who don't come from an experience of knowing that, just didn't know. They just didn't know. And a lot of it had to do with race, but a lot of it also had to do with class. A lot of it also had to do with just who they've had to interact with or not. They didn't even know, like, oh, I'm coming off like that? Really, Caitlin? I didn't know. And it's like, yeah, let's just talk about it. Let's just talk about it and work on it. Because I know people have done that for me around a bunch of different things, which is why I'm even here, you know, real talk. People have been patient with me, so we can be patient with each other. And sometimes I think there's this thing like, well, I know how to talk to people, so I, you know, my work is just to go do a good job, you know? Well, no, our work is to help us be doing better together. So
it's humbling. That work is very humbling. It never stops. It just never stops. So we are coming to the end of our time. Anything that we didn't ask you that you want to say, Caitlin? 30 Days of Love. When does it start? Where can people find out more about it?
Yep. Go to standingonthesideoflove.org, our website. It's going to be kicking off right around MLK weekend. So same thing. We know announcements are coming out about the UUA presidency, so we're trying to time well to be helpful and relevant. Yeah, you know, I think the only other thing I'd love to say is that I'm really excited. I'm really excited that at this moment, standing on the side of love is going in this direction of asking both of these questions at once, right? How does standing on the side of love continue to be this powerful mobilization engine and body for UUs and accountable to the congregations and people on the ground, particularly accountability in terms of support and help? And then on the other hand, how does all that infrastructure and that the power and influence be accountable to our movement in this moment? So, you know, as we're kind of building and I'm getting to journey with some of you, I'm really excited that somebody who feels accountable to movement, even when I screw up, gets to be in this role. And I'm also really excited about being accountable to the great work on the ground that folks have been doing in this name and in this campaign. And I want to say thank you to everybody for having me. I want to say a special thank you to Meg, because I think Sizzle's such a great idea. It's such a great gift. And I wouldn't be here if y'all hadn't built it. And I think it's really, I think it's really great.
Well, thank you. I have to agree. It's one that really worked. Of many that have gone right by, so it's wonderful to watch people take it up and carry it where they go with it. Next week we have Bob. Who do we have?
Black Lives of UU.
Black Lives of UU for their monthly update for us about what's going on. It's been wonderful to have Caitlin Breedlove. Go to standingonthesideoflove.org. I want to say a special thank you to all the people who helped CLF make our end of year fiscal year fund drive. So many of you stepped forward. Truly, I felt bathed in love. We took a risk going with Lena in the streets and saying we can do it, and we can do the missional work and the fundraising, and we did. And thank you to all of you who let us know that the work matters. See you all next time.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.